The following programming is sponsored by the Pennsylvania Pro-Life Federation. The views expressed do not necessarily reflect the views of this station, its management, or Beasley Media Group.
Women have a history of rising above. When they blocked our right to vote, we marched. When they paid us less, we secured equal pay. When they devalued us, we built a movement. Now they tell us we need abortion to succeed, that abortion is part of our empowerment. But there's no victory in ending the lives of our own children. There's no empowerment. There's only harm and loss. Abortion hurts. It leaves us with a giant hole in who we are. When someone tells us we are not up for the challenge of being a mother, let's remind them who we are, what we have overcome, how we have risen above. We don't need abortion to succeed.
Welcome. You're listening to Positively Pro-Life, a podcast brought to you by the Pennsylvania Pro-Life Federation. On this podcast, we aim to bring you inspirational stories and conversation, important legislative updates and informative interviews as we seek to restore and strengthen a culture of life. I'm your host, Ramil Tenney, Education Director at the Federation, and joining me is my co-host and Executive Director, Maria Gallagher. Welcome, Maria.
Ramil, it's great to be with you today.
Well, it is quite the day, and we just got through a very exciting night of waiting for the election results, and what a relief. So, Maria, I'm just going to give you a little bit of time to tell us about how our nation's future is looking in terms of the pro-life issue at this point.
I would say the nation's future looks a lot brighter as a result of the 2024 election. We definitely had some pro-life victories on election night. Abortion was on the ballot in some states, and most notably, Florida defeated a pro-abortion amendment. Thousands of lives may be saved as a result of that vote. Also, West Virginia approved a measure that would protect its citizens from assisted suicide. And there was the election of a number of pro-life public officials. And as a result of that, threats such as taxpayer funding of abortion may not be as great. Still, Ramil, we must be vigilant.
We must. And I have to say, on a national level, though, there's almost a poetic justice to witnessing the downfall of a party platform that literally built itself up on the death of innocent lives. And I have to say, I was very relieved when I woke up this morning and saw the news. At least on a federal level, the fight continues on the state level, which is a lot to hope for. So with that, we are going to start a conversation today. On the podcast, we're going to be talking about the ethics of organ donation and about a controversial procedure that might be concerning if approved and adopted. More on that soon after Maria gives her update for the week.
Ramil, the following was submitted as a letter to the editor by National Right to Life to the New York Times. Kate Zernike, writing in Late Abortions Rarely Happen, But They Still Dominate Politics, on October 31st, uses data from the Centers for Disease Control's inadequate and incomplete reporting system to argue that late in pregnancy abortions are so rare as to be virtually non-existent. The CDC passively collects abortion data volunteered by states. There are two significant problems with this system. First, there are often only 47 reporting areas. States like California and Maryland, states that have the most liberal abortion laws in the nation, don't provide abortion statistics to the CDC. Second, of those 47 reporting areas in 2021, 41 of the 47 reported abortions after 21 weeks of pregnancy, an estimated total of 9,300. The other six provided no abortion numbers. To extrapolate from these thin, underreported statistics that abortions late in pregnancy are rare or performed in limited circumstances is a masterclass in circular reasoning. The abortion industry and its supporters oppose reporting requirements, but they challenge us to find the statistics that they don't want to report and insist don't exist. They insultingly tell us, move along, nothing to see here. Remmel.
Thank you, Maria, for that update. To think of even one life that can be taken at 32 weeks, 34 weeks is really abhorrent. And I don't know why it's good to have statistics, but even the idea, I think, should really be something that speaks to us about trying to make abortion unthinkable. So thank you for that very informative and educational piece. Now, on to our interview. Our guest today is Philip Cerrone, an associate ethicist at the National Catholic Bioethics Center, NCBC for short, who focuses on increasing engagement with the NCBC's mission and programs among individual, diocesan, and institutional stakeholders. Philip joined the NCBC in 2016 as an editor in the publications department before becoming the managing editor of the National Catholic Bioethics Quarterly and production manager for the department in 2019. He earned a master's in public health and epidemiology from Temple University in Philadelphia in 2020 and an MS in bioethics from the University of Mary in Bismarck, North Dakota in 2022. He is currently also studying for his doctorate in bioethics at Pontifical Athenaeum Regina Apostolorum in Rome. Welcome, Philip, to Positively Pro-Life.
Thank you for having me, Ramil.
Yeah, we're very glad that we're able to have this conversation today, and we're going to be talking about organ donation. So I just want to start us off with this question of, is organ donation ethical?
Yes, there's consensus among recent popes and theologians that organ donation is an act of charity at the service of human life. I think probably for people who really want to look at church teaching on organ donation, probably the best place to look is John Paul II's 2000 address to the Transplantation Society. You can Google it, English version's available. And I think that that probably has still the best and most complete summary of what the church thinks about organ donation and also how church teaching relates to practices such as brain death. But back to, whether organ donation is ethical, the magisterial sources say that, as an act of charity, and I think this is important for the justification, that as an act of charity, it's just as important that the donor is engaging in a personal human act of self-expression and gift without reward as it is that the donor is giving a thing that belongs to them, a life-saving transplant, to the recipient. And we might talk about that a little bit later, but this helps really keep the focus on the people, on that, humanizing aspect of it, and rather than giving into that tendency to look at vulnerable people at the end of life just as sources of organs.
What are the circumstances under which organ donation is likely to take place?
Yeah, I think that before we talk about that specific, I think we need to, and it's going to be important for a lot of this discussion, is how death is determined in the United States. And the legal standards for death are governed by what's called the Uniform Determination of Death Act, UDDA. And so it says that there are two sets of criteria that can be used to determine death. And so somebody can be declared dead after either the irreversible cessation of all respiratory and circulatory function, or the irreversible cessation of all activity of the brain. So what we would call the circulatory death, which is kind of our traditional idea of determining death when somebody stops breathing and their heart stops beating, or brain death. And I'll mention it here because it will come up later, is in the US, the legal standard is irreversible. Now, in other parts of the world, Europe and Canada particularly, it's not irreversible. It's permanent cessation. And you can probably just start to guess the significance of that difference, whether death is the irreversible cessation of these functions or the permanent cessation of these functions. And earlier this year, there was an attempt to change the UDDA to reflect that permanent standard versus the irreversible standard. And that was defeated in large part because of the good work of the Catholic Medical Association. But directly to the question that you're asking, the circumstances in which organ donation are likely to take place is it depends on the organs being retrieved. So many organs and tissues can be retrieved after somebody passes away and is declared dead by the circulatory criteria. And because these tissues and organs don't really suffer that much deterioration after death. And so this would be eyes, tendons, skin, mainly tissue donation. However, many major organs, such as your heart and your lungs, and your kidneys, although that goes both ways, they deteriorate very quickly after blood stops flowing, oxygenated blood stops flowing to them. So those are usually retrieved after a determination of brain death, because if somebody had been declared brain dead, they say, "Hey, this is a corpse," but oxygen is still, oxygenated blood is still being pumped to the different organs, so they don't deteriorate. So because so many of these unpaired vital organs are retrieved almost exclusively after determination of brain death, healthcare professionals are constantly looking for ways to expand the donor pool for these rare life-saving organs.
Well, you had pointed out to us, you'd brought to our attention that there is a procedure that's a little controversial, called a normothermic regional perfusion, NRP. Can you tell us a little bit more about the process and why it should concern us?
Yeah, absolutely. So NRP is a technique, and it pretty much is meant to say, "Hey, how can we get the results, the transplantation results that we get after brain death with circulatory death?" And so it's a technique of organ retrieval that's used after determination of death by the circulatory criteria. And it reduces the damage due to lack of blood flow to the major organs. And we'll go into how it does this, but by perfusing the organs with oxygenated blood. So it's more cost-effective than many other methods of organ retrieval, and it has better outcomes. You're not having the organs aren't deteriorating because of lack of blood flow. So happens in and we're going to talk about mainly thoracoabdominal NRP. So pretty much NRP where you're perfusing the heart and the abdomen. There's another form where it's just the abdomen, but it's virtually the same thing. So what happens in NRP is before organs can be retrieved, there's a 5-minute hands-off period after cardiopulmonary activity ceases. And the idea is that, and this is not a uncontentious idea, but the idea is that after 5 minutes, somebody won't auto-resuscitate. So the idea is, okay, well, they're dead after 5 minutes is what, let's say, the common wisdom is. So after 5 minutes, so 5 minutes after a heartbeat ceases, the transplant team connects what's called an extracorporeal membrane oxygenation, or ECMO device, to the donor. And then clamps his or her carotid arteries. And these are the arteries that go to the brain. So the oxygen, so the ECMO device is connected to the heart, to the right atria, the right atrium of the heart, and to the aorta, which is the largest artery, blood going to all of your organs from the heart through the aorta to the rest of your organs. So deoxygenated blood from the right atrium of the donor's heart drains into the ECMO device, where it's oxygenated, warmed, and then pumped back into the body through the aorta. So in other words, instead of going from the right atrium to the right ventricle to the lungs to the left atrium to the left ventricle to the aorta, you skip the lungs, and then it's pumped back into the body, where then it enters systemic circulation, perfuses all of those vital organs in your abdomen, in your thoracic, in your chest, before then it circulates back through your venous system to the heart and to the ECMO device, which to the ECMO device. So that's how you're getting oxygenated blood. And now, since of course you are supplying blood to the heart through the coronary artery, after a few minutes the heart will begin to beat, and in some cases, in fact, the transplant team can wean the person, the donor, off of the ECMO device. So then, but and so 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 and then the clamps that we talked about on the aorta, the I mean, I'm sorry, on the carotid arteries, those prevent oxygenated blood from circulating to the brain. So pretty much we are circulating, mechanically circulating blood to the major organs, but keeping that blood from getting to the brain. So the major ethical concern is that organ donors may not be deceased when this technique is used. So, there are a number of common objections and responses to NRP. And the so in these common arguments, the ethical and legal objections and supports are intertwined. And they involve, as we said, the UDDA, this how do you determine death? And then also an ethical principle called the dead donor rule, which is pretty simple. It's saying, hey, you can't take organs from somebody, you can't take vital organs from somebody until they're dead, and you can't kill somebody by taking their organs. So I would say you can summarize the objections to NRP this way. And of course, there's a lot of different objections, but I think you can summarize them and say, if you declare somebody dead because their circulation has stopped, and then you restart circulation, is the person really dead? And then additionally, because NRP starts so soon after circulation stops, there still can be brain activity or function. So preventing blood flow to the brain may actually be what kills the person. So in other words, before this person is actually dead, you kill them by stop by keep by cutting off their any blood and any oxygen from their brain. So proponents of NRP respond to these objections in a number of ways. And as you'll see, most of these justifications rely on the standard, that permanent standard, so that death is not the irreversible loss of circulatory function or brain function, it's only the permanent loss. So one, I think that this is probably the strongest argument they have, is that although NRP restores function to some vital organs, it does not resuscitate the patient. That is, it does not restore integrated function to the organism. And as we'll see in a little bit, this is the one that speaks most closely to, say, the Catholic and the Church's discussion of the person. Now, I think there are a lot of problems with this response, but I think that's the strongest. And then they have some other ones, like you can't resuscitate a patient without intending to. So as long as you're only trying to oxygenate certain organs, you're not resuscitating the donor. I think this was kind of ridiculous. Law, common sense, and most moral codes all say intention and action are two different things. You can do the same thing for any number of reasons or intentions. And just because you don't intend to do it or it's not your primary goal doesn't mean you aren't doing it anyway.
So to put it simply, we're talking about organs being kept alive through artificial circulation of blood, but the person, but it's not being moved, allowed to go into the brain so that the person has a chance at life. Like the person's not fully dead and you still have organs that are artificially kept alive in for the sake of harvesting or for the sake of donating these organs. So what are some of the concerns, as in, would there be a chance of abuse if NRP is applied, if it's adopted?
Well, I mean, as far as abuse, I'm sorry.
Is this going to lead?
Yeah, I mean, yes. Oh, that's a different one. You said, can it be abused? Yeah, I mean, I would say that the question is, and the fundamental question is NRP an abuse in itself? So, you know, obviously, if it is in fact taking organs from somebody before they're dead, which is the question, is saying, hey, does this donor state indicate that they're alive or does it indicate that they're dead? So if they are alive, it is an abuse intrinsically. If not, you know, if they are in fact dead, then I would say that abuse would really depend on, you know, whether there are situations in which NRP the person may still be alive, or, you know, situations in which they're clearly not alive. I would say that probably has something to do with how quickly you initiate it. I mean, obviously, the longer you wait, the more certain, you know, that you are that this person is deceased, that their integrated function as an organism has ceased. But yeah, there's definitely a large worry for abuse.
I used to be a designated organ donor on my driver's license. And I think a lot of us, when we're young, are drawn to that because we want to be giving people, we want to be life-affirming people, we want to help people. But is there a danger in agreeing to be an organ donor because of the threat of possible euthanasia?
I mean, there is, but I don't think that we should overstate the concern. I mean, I would say that, you know, the risk of euthanasia is, I would say, present whether somebody is an organ donor or not. And it's really the real task is to have a good surrogate decision maker and really talk with them about what the definition of euthanasia is, how they should try to make healthcare decisions for you to avoid euthanasia. You know, the church, and I think this is just a good rational definition of euthanasia, says it's any action or omission that hastens the death of a patient, either as an end in itself or as the means to some other end, such as organ transplantation or to end all pain, right? And so probably, you know, most people are probably more at risk of euthanasia from having life-sustaining treatment inappropriately withdrawn at the end of life than they, which is an act of omission. You aren't providing nutrition and hydration to somebody. Than they are of, you know, somebody retrieving their organs while they're still living or something like that, since that first one is a much more common occurrence. But I mean, the church, you know, has a good way to address this. over the centuries, the church has developed this ordinary, extraordinary means distinction for evaluating treatment. You know, the idea that ordinary means are obligatory parts of our duty to preserve our own lives, and extraordinary means are not obligatory. And real quick, I know we're getting to the end here. You know, ordinary means are those that have a reasonable hope of benefit and do not entail an excessive burden on the patient or an excessive expense on the family or the community. And those are obligatory. And extraordinary means are ones that either do not have a reasonable hope of benefit or impose an excessive burden on the patient or excessive expense on the family or the community. So as long as you're giving somebody ordinary means, you don't have to give extraordinary means, but as long as you're giving ordinary means and you're making, you know, the care decisions with that in mind and with the criteria for that, you're not going to be euthanizing anybody, because you're going to be giving them, because all you're going to, you know, if they die, they're dying because you've foregone some burdensome treatment that, you know, the causes more harm than benefit, but you aren't hastening somebody's death directly. So, I would say that's really, whether you're talking about organ donation, whether you're talking about any other end of life issue, that really, you know, making sure your surrogate understands the difference between ordinary and extraordinary means.
We've got just about a minute left, and I'm wondering if people have additional questions, because I think that this is a very deep topic for discussion. Where can they go? What should they do?
I think probably one of the best places is in 2020, the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith promulgated a document called Samaritanus Bonus. That's just Good Samaritan in Latin. And it's pretty much a summary of church teaching on end-of-life care. And I'm going to say that's going to give you 80% of what you need. Our website, ncbcenter.org, also has a number of resources.
Wonderful. Positively Pro-Life is made possible through the generous support of the members of the Pennsylvania Pro-Life Federation all across the Commonwealth. Thanks for joining us today. And remember, there's always a reason to choose life.